Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/goyourownya. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, including this week's book, The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland in a Ship of Her Own Making, by Catherine M. Valenti, narrated by the author. That's audibletrial.com/goyourownya for your free audiobook.
Talking about young adult literature is not for the faint of heart. There's fashion atrocities, queer subtext, problematic love interests, and that's just for a start. But never fear, because Carrie and Murray are here, and this is Go Your Own YA.
Hi, and welcome to Go Your Own YA. I'm Marie.
And I'm Carrie.
There's a Bigfoot!
Here I am, and I'm very creepy and spooky. You guys found
me. You sound creepy and spooky. Tell us who you are, Bigfoot, and why, as a mythological creature, are you qualified to talk about young adult literature?
Well, my street name is Layla. I'm from the podcast Bigfoot and Bob, which is all about creepy, spooky, cryptid, monstery, horror things. And I'm qualified to talk about young adult literature because for most of my life, I've been a consumer of that and adult literature and old adult literature. And I've even written some stuff myself.
That is awesome. We're so glad to have you on today.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about Bigfoot and Bob?
Well, we're a fairly new podcast. We've only got about 9 episodes out so far. But it's me and my fiance, Ryan, who is the titular Bob. And we talk about things that are on the fringes of society, things like aliens and cryptids and monsters especially. We talk about horror movies, books, comics, games. We talk about all the things that might haunt your nightmares, but we do it in a really funny way, so it's a lot of fun. We do swear, though, so, you know, be warned.
That's okay, so do we.
You swear very entertainingly.
Oh, thank you.
I cried laughing at the Muppet episode.
I really wanted to talk about the Muppets, and I was like, well, they're kind of like monsters, right? Yeah, let's do it.
Some of them are. I'm so excited to hear that episode. Marie recommended that one to me as where I should start, and I love the Muppets, so.
Yes.
I'm psyched. Now, you picked our book this week, as has become our tradition with our guests. Tell us a little bit about what book you picked and what made you bring this one to the podcast today.
Well, this book is called The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland in a Ship of Her Own Making. And I had not read it before, but it was recommended as a book that I would like since I shared my favorite young adult novels, and this was really similar to some of the books that I loved. I'll get into what books it reminds me of specifically later on, but it's a really wonderful book by Catherine M. Valenti, and I had a blast reading it. It's a lot of fun. It's about a young girl who, well, circumnavigates fairyland in a ship of her own making, and she's phenomenal. She's very relatable to anyone who's ever been young.
And heartless.
And heartless, as we all once were.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I should probably admit that you gave us a list of books you were into, and when you said that, I was like, oh, you should read Fairyland, because it fits perfectly into our little, like, the 1999 to 2010, almost, like, golden age of young adult. And anybody who reads and loves the books you mentioned should read and love this book.
Yes, I agree. It's a lot of fun. I didn't know what exactly to expect. The description reminded me a little bit of, the older Oz books, Summerland a little bit, maybe some Discworld.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know what to expect going in, but I was glad I read it. It's phenomenal. And it, It's one of those books where you can tell where the influences came from, and that makes it more enjoyable, not less.
Absolutely. Now, I'll confess, as long as we're confessing, I had never read this one. It had been sitting on my shelf since it came out. And in my defense, like 2011, 2012, really, really kind of sucky years for me. So this one I did not get to until about a week and a half ago. And just like you, I kind of tore through it. It was just so wonderfully written. And September, our heroine, our heartless young heroine, is a joy to read about.
Yes.
And cheer on.
She's extremely relatable. And a lot of protagonists, you know, can fall into that trap of not having enough personality so as to allow the reader to slip more easily into the role. But September has a great personality. She's full of life. You can really imagine her as a character in her own right. And it cracked me up because when I was 11 or 12 and going up until I turned about 20, my online and writing persona was often called October in a lot of circles. So that cracked me
up. Now, Marie, I'm guessing you read this book when it came out.
I did, and I came to it in the way that I feel it's a sort of unusual nowadays, that I had read her book, Palimpsest, which turns on this then fictional book, The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland. And Captain Volante, like, Palimpsest is one of those books where readers just decided they hated it and they were going to take the author to task for not writing a book that met their standards. And it really hurt Catherine Valente because, you know, she is a writer of flesh and blood and ink. And if you hear screaming in the background, that's Ramona.
Aw, hi, Ramona.
She's very cute, but very loud. And sort of as a healing process for herself, she started writing the story and it became crowdfunded and she originally published it all on her website. I did not read it when it was on her website, but I did get it like when it came out in hardcover and read it and absolutely loved it.
That's phenomenal. I love books with alternative publishing sources or origins, especially on the internet.
I was just going to say, I love the idea of reading this book in installments. And I tried to do that when I was reading it, knowing that's how it had originally been published. And just reading like one or two chapters at a time. And then by the end, I couldn't do that anymore. So it was like, I'm just going to read the whole thing because I can, like binge watching rather than waiting for the next episode of a show I binge read.
Yeah.
I've said on the podcast, we've talked a lot about alternate publishing methods for stories that don't quite fit in the norm. And now Catherine Valente is, you know, a celebrated author. And despite the blip that was Palimpsest, and which I read and I enjoyed, it's been 4 or 5 years since I've read it. So I don't know if there's problematic stuff in it. Let me read it and get back to y'all. But we've talked about like alternative publishing being a means to get a story that doesn't fit the very narrow publishing standards out there. And, you know, this is a very happy story because it went on to become a New York Times bestseller, probably because it built up this cult following beforehand.
Yeah, which is tricky, but if you can get it, you know, you want to hold on to it.
Mm-hmm. Right. I feel like that was something that was easier to do back then. And it feels strange to say back then about like 7 years ago. But seriously, right? Way back in the day.
Ugh, my old bones.
I'm 39. I don't want to hear about anybody else's old bones. I'm probably the oldest one here today.
Fair enough.
There's definitely some silica and the lavender putty I'm playing with that's probably older than you, Carrie.
Carrie Farrell, not as old as silica. It took my brain and invent dirt
to process that sentence.
It's okay, Carrie. Make fun of me for being short.
Ha ha, I can reach things you can't. I'll work on that.
Okay. So we should begin the story, begin the podcast, I should say, maybe looking at some of those influences that so clearly show their mark on the story, but in a really beautiful, mesmerizing kind of way.
Oh, yes. And I briefly looked over the section in the back of the book that was a bit of an interview with the author, so I do know that one of the things that influenced it was, in fact, Discworld. And I think I can guess that the We Free Men got in there somewhere, because September is yes. a lot along the lines of Tiffany Aching from those books.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Who is also one of my favorite female protagonists, so I'm totally okay with that.
And I know she's spoken about Oz, and you mentioned that you're the Oz expert. And I've only read the first one, and I really enjoyed it back when I was about 7 or 8. And I could see that L. Frank Baum touch on a narrative, like the very inventive ideas and this very sort of American mythos. Although in this book, she brings in a whole world's group of characters to share in a narrative.
Yeah, original setting, where are they? Omaha?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that's very reminiscent of Oz. You know, you have your young female protagonist who's restless, who's living in the sort of boring part of America that you might see. No offense if anyone lives in Omaha, but I've driven through there and I know. And the fairies themselves, there's a lot of really fantastic parts that reminded me of the Oz books. There are quite a few more of them than people seem to realize. There were, I think, 14 originals that were written by L. Frank Baum himself, and then the series was continued on by others after his death. So there's quite a rich history of the Oz books. And a lot of the characters, like the Cowardly Lion, have more counterparts in the series, like the Hungry Tiger, who longs to eat fat babies but is too kind-hearted to ever actually kill a baby.
Aww. Aww.
A lot of the characters in here remind me of that, like A through L, the
yeah.
who is just fantastic, the bookish wyvern. It reminds me a lot of characters like the Hungry Tiger or the Woozy from Oz. Intimidating and should be fierce, but have some kind of quirk and are secretly very kind.
Yeah, the characters that September meets along her journey are so great. Every single one of them, I feel like, should get their own story, kind of never-ending story, the book mm-hmm. style.
Yes. Love that book.
Another story and shall be told another time.
Oh.
That's one of the books I was thinking of reading this, except female heroine, yay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And not only a female heroine, but a world with not only male and female characters, but multiple and non-binary characters
yes!
inhabit it.
Yeah.
I love that so much. Wonderful thing to see in this book.
Yeah. It's a breath of fresh air.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in how Ozma of Oz compares to the Marquess.
Oh, yes. Well, Ozma has always been a sympathetic character who, even though she had to make hard decisions sometimes, was never put in an antagonistic role. She began, you know, as a boy, of course, and was eventually restored to her rightful form as a girl and the Princess of Oz by Dorothy's help. But, you know, the Marquess has kind of a more varied backstory and is a little more interesting to me than Ozma, which is hard to say, but I love characters like the Marquess. I think if Dorothy had gone home and grown up and not returned to Oz for a bit, she would have ended up maybe like the Marquess.
And it really brings it because without spoiling too much of the Marquess's story, she is one of the tragedies of what happens when somebody is snatched from a life they've created in another world. And then has to claw her way back. Like, that is what drives her. And it's incredibly, incredibly tragic. I don't know if, like, child readers will understand, like, how tragic it is. Because it's definitely one of those things that hits me harder every time I read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It reads a lot like those alternative retellings of the Narnia stories.
Mm-hmm. Yes! I was thinking of those.
Same here. Yep. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about that before on the podcast, but I don't think we have linked to them. I'm sure they're still on Tumblr, so those alternate retellings of Susan's story and Lucy's story.
Yeah. Because, man, C.S. Lewis, these kids grew up and had families and grew old and died and then woke up as children again, and they're fine. Okay.
Like, that doesn't happen.
That's not how it works.
No.
Are you sure that's how it would go, C.S. Lewis?
Like, do you know how to adult? From the stories we heard, like the one we told in the Howl episode, I'm not sure if any of the Inklings knew how to adult.
No.
They could write beautifully, but mostly they had their wives and housekeepers handling the adult stuff.
Ugh, sounds yeah. Nice.
Right? No, let's get us some of those.
So I wanted to ask if you had noticed, because maybe circling back around to plot and structure and all those things. I'm sorry, I jumped right in, but I was thinking of Ozma. And Ozma is such a cool heroine, and sort of, you know, decades and decades before, in the same way, L. Frank Baum has this kind of really, really forward-thinking transformation happen to his character. And it happens kind of in the same way that a lot of alternative and diverse identities are in this book, and they get away with it because it's a children's fantasy.
Oh, yes. And L. Frank Baum, I could talk about his story forever, because his wife was actually really close friends with some of the original suffragettes who made huge advances for women in early American history. And he was completely in support of her. He ended up even changing some of his own viewpoints and was very, very feminist in his views for the time. And even refused to put romance in his books because he believed that children shouldn't be thinking about that kind of thing. And young girls could think of themselves as adventurers rather than love interests.
That is so beautiful.
So I guess the way to begin, it's hard to begin with the story because in the New Yorker article on it, it says one of the key charms of the book is that everything in this story is meaningful. Like every paragraph, every description, everything. I think the way to describe it is, if most fantasy and YA novels are like the breakfast cereals that kids sift through in search of marshmallows and clusters of fruit, Valente's novels are all marshmallows and clusters, with every page a symbol, a saying, and a display, either of quasi-steampunk feminist magic turned up to 10, or the same thing turned up past 11. So if we skip around a lot, it's because there's so many things to cover.
And the book is, oops, all berries.
Yes. That's exactly what I was about to say.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about some parts of it without worrying about spoilers or ruining anything for future readers who are listening. So I'm having a tough time knowing where to begin.
We can talk about September to begin, maybe.
Yes.
One thing I wanted to see if both of you noticed, she's biracial. So her mother is white and her father is POC.
Yes.
Who noticed that?
Yeah.
And it's also confirmed by Catherine Valente. A few people have headcasted her, and she has definitely confirmed that that she's biracial. And, you know, reading it over again, I've noticed some things about her life back home where I think Valente, as a white writer, is taking it the right way. Like, she's not going into detail or not making it, you know, like a story. You understand what I'm saying.
Yes.
But she does say, like, the one that stuck with me was, everybody thinks that her mother was so independent that nobody gave her help. And I'm like, Oh, they are leaving their family alone because she married a man of color. And it's Omaha, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Shunning them a little bit.
Yeah. September's mother, what we see of her, is a very interesting character. There are very obvious clues as to what time period September is living in and what her mother is doing for a job that make it very interesting.
And it's one of those things where Valente could so easily say, oh, she was, you know, part of the war effort because women did this. But, you know, once the war was over and her father comes home, she had her dresses back on and she'd be baking again. But no, her mother is an engineer. She's always fixing things for their neighbors. And she's teaching her daughter how to fix things and also how to love books, just like her father did.
Yes.
And does. And in the later books, it's not a spoiler because I think it's a good reason to keep reading the series, as Baroque as it gets. And I do promise, like, stick with it. It's really good. The family, her father and her mother, become characters in the story, and they have their own narratives.
Ooh, I can't wait to read the sequels.
That is so good to hear. I know.
Yeah. No, for 100% recommended. And the ending, like, the ultimate ending is not what you expect, but it's very good. Mm. So September is a really wonderful, like, quintessential children's, you know, like, Carrie and I talk about, like, middle grade versus YA versus new adult a lot. And I think this book is, like, the ultimate Y categories help sell books, but also they're kind of dumb.
Yes. This is a book that would be placed squarely within the children's section, but it is a book that is so good, I think, for YA readers and for adult readers. And the narrative voice is directed very much toward an adult audience, even though the protagonist is a young girl. And I think no matter what age you are, you're going to get a lot out of this story and out of September's journey.
Absolutely. When I was reading this, I realized it had been too long since I read any young adult literature because I had been diving more into my store of Michael Crichton books and scientific mysteries and things like that. And it is so nice to have a return to the magic and joy of a fantasy world. And I think this is a great starting place because it's very, parts of it are very old-fashioned, the narrative style, some of the fantasy world settings feel very, very familiar if you've read a lot of old fantasy and fairy stories. But it's all brought into a more modern feel and appeal in a very, I guess, Terry Pratchett, again, way.
There's a lot of Terry Pratchett in this, but only in the best way.
Oh, yes.
Yes, there's no footnotes. if, like me, those footnotes annoy you.
It is hard to portray
them. I'm so clever. Like, Terry Pratchett always seems to be just showing off a little bit too much for me to appreciate him the way other people I know and love appreciate him.
Oh, well. But at least he doesn't write himself into his stories as a character like Stephen King does.
Oh, that's right.
No, see, I do love Terry Pratchett, and I love his later novels because I feel like he plots a lot more tightly, and he is somebody where I feel like his stories are best shown off when he's got the plot all settled and he can be wildly inventive and imaginative and still hit the story beats.
Yes.
For me, but I also, and my brother has like every Discworld book ever, so I understand the appeal and I respect it. I think he's fantastic. And his legacy is incredible, of course.
And so this book has all the things that people love about Terry Pratchett, I think, just rolled up in a lovely little package. It's very clever in a lot of ways, but it's never, as I said, too in love with its cleverness, and it's full of eccentric and charming characters, and the language in this book. I was hoping to write down some passages that I loved, and it was impossible to do because there's so many. The sensory details are gorgeous. I just want to like roll around in her descriptions of autumn or her descriptions of the world September encounters. Just gorgeous writing.
Yes, the parts about autumn felt very self-indulgent to me, but in a relatable way because I love autumn that much as well. And
I do too.
Oh, it's so nice
exactly.
to see.
One of the things about the story is that, you know, of course, September is given rules when she's spirited away to fairyland. And one of them is she can't eat fairy food. And we've known this ever since the very earliest fairy stories, like going back to Goblin Market, going back to the Fairy Queen. But, you know, September is a flesh and blood girl in fairyland. She has to eat. She always manages to explain, well, this is witch food. This is dragon food. If I'm eating it with a dragon, it's dragon food. Or this is just, you know, water from the sea. And then finally, somebody in the Autumn Lands tells her, you know, this is fairyland. It's all fairy food. And she's like, meow it. And feasts all night in the Autumn Kingdom on autumn food. And it all sounds so
yes.
good.
All the pumpkin foods.
Yes. It gets a little close to that Onion article about Mr. Autumn Man. Mr. Autumn Man walking down the street with his pumpkin spice latte and his sweater, sniffing the leaves.
I take personal offense to that. I'm Mr. Autumn Man.
I am Mrs. Autumn Woman all the way. Yes, I felt personally attacked by that article.
We're just trying to enjoy our crispy leaves and our drinks. Come on.
Just let us drink our lattes.
God. They don't do this to winter people.
Amen. Winter in New York means a lot of Midwesterners telling you, this isn't winter.
Hi.
Trust me, you don't know winter.
I see, from you, it's different because also you understand, like, some, because Carrie is from the Baltimore area. So you understand, like, that Atlantic coast winter where, you know, it is cold to us who have only experienced that winter.
Yes.
It is cold and damp. But yes, I know I have not experienced a true Midwestern winter. And I also have not experienced real Seattle weather because of the 10 days I have been there, 9 of them were sunny.
Yeah, we get that a lot. People coming and being like, where's the rain? Well, guys, it doesn't rain that much. It rains a lot, but not that much. We have pretty good summers.
I've been there in fall and late summer, and it was, you know, if you go back and listen to me, I'm obsessed with Seattle.
Good.
So.
Last time I was there was, 2014, when you guys had heat and didn't know what to do with it? August 2014, all of a sudden, temperatures got really high, and everyone was like, but we don't have air conditioning, and we're dying because my husband and I, like, run on air conditioning.
Let's see, 2014, August, I was 2 years out of high school, and I was driving around in a convertible, and my friends and I were probably drinking orange juice by the gallon and swimming at Alki Beach.
Amazing.
That sounds great. We should have
been
doing that.
Yeah, this is like fairyland to adult me. It's like, you have trees there.
It really, I will always be passionate about the Pacific Northwest because we have every kind of biome except tundra. We have these beautiful mountains, this gorgeous ocean, the most breathtaking sights. We even have a rainforest. I go camping in a rainforest on an almost monthly basis. It's bananas. Everyone needs to come try it.
And I think one of the, it in some ways, the story has its touch of urban fantasy, which was another thing it holds in common with the Oz books. Because I was just thinking, like, all the ways that you could take elements from our different cities and make them into something magical. Like, Seattle has an entire underground city.
Yes.
Like, what is that? And it's haunted.
Well, listen to our Bigfoot and Bob episode about the Haunted Underground tour coming up within the next couple months, and you'll find out.
Amazing. Awesome. I have been on that tour.
So good. It smells bad down there, though.
It really does.
It smells like ghosts.
And then Carrie in Chicago.
There's a lot of bureaucracy.
Oh, very, very relatable to this book.
Ever tried to go to City Hall and get anything done in Chicago? That is, or the post office.
Sounds hellish.
Ever, if you ever want to waste some time and feel better about where you live, go to Yelp and look up reviews of the Ravenswood post office in Chicago.
That sounds like something straight out of this book.
Yeah. It's 100%. The things that I have seen at that post office, which is where I used to live before we moved a little bit north into a bit of suburbia.
You lived in a post office.
It's I lived right by the post office. I lived in a package and nobody would open me.
Maybe you weren't properly stamped.
That was the problem. And I kept telling them I'm right here. Nope. But yeah, Ravenswood post office, definitely a setting in this book.
God, the bureaucracy scenes in here messed me
up.
Yes. They were, ugh, I was uncomfortable. I can't deal with that.
Yes. I love how they work on multiple levels. Like, I can see it as something a kid would be like, tee-hee, adult stuff. And an adult reads it and like, I feel so attacked right now by all of this.
But Marie, I wonder if there was something more positive you were going to say about My Fair City.
I was going to talk about the magical beaches right in the middle of the city, but with their tall ships and their sand and their shells and their puppies. But, you know.
Puppies. Well, my puppy doesn't like the beach. We live 4 blocks from the beach, but no. Puppy will not go on the sand and puppy will not go near the water.
Aww.
But that is magical. Thanks. And then we've got New York.
We have tiny forests in the middle of our cities. I live right by Prospect Park, and I have, of course, been to Central Park. And I will say they've got nothing on Volunteer Park or Golden Gate, but they are our own and they are beautiful. And every time I go to Prospect Park, I find something new. And we will have show notes, I promise. And when we do, I will link some things about it because there are some truly magical and strange spots.
Yes. And Central Park I've been to, and I went to see the Balto statue because my day job is a dog trainer and caretaker and everything about dogs I'm totally obsessed with. But also there's a fairy tale castle there where people get married.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
That's pretty dang magical.
Most cities have something. I mean, a lot of places have something to recommend them. Like, I rag on my hometown a lot. But even that, you know, we've got oceans. We've got parks. We've got hidden spots. We've got a historical house that was owned by one of the foremost female photographers that was a huge meow lesbian and took pictures of her friends being lesbians all
nice.
Over.
That sounds great. I'm betting even Omaha has something to recommend it.
No doubt. Even if it's the biggest ball of twine.
Oh, that's in Minnesota.
My bad.
Yeah, but there is a wonderful sense of place in these books, and this book especially, you know, setting. I want to know, like, do you guys have a favorite, like, scene or setting in this book?
Well, shoot.
I think you already heard my thoughts on Autumnland.
Yeah, me too. It's just so perfect. I guess the velocipedes really...
Yes, I was going to say
that. Yeah, they're adorable. I love making inanimate objects animate, like in the So You Want to Be a Wizard books with the living helicopters.
I don't think we've read them yet, but we will have
yes.
to now.
Oh my god, some of my favorite books. I actually have a tattoo from that series, and it's worth looking into.
Amazing. Yeah. I know there's a book about whales, and I love yes. whales, so I'm excited about that.
So many whales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Calpurnia and her changing child and the herd of roving velocipedes. It's a wonderful, evocative scene. It's a scene where a woman is doing things. In yes. fact, you could call this entire book Women Doing Things. And I am of the 90s, where there is more than one woman doing something in children's media. I get really excited.
And Calpurnia and her adopted daughter are phenomenal.
So good.
It's all very charming and old-timey, because when you think of velocipedes, I do enjoy how that's the particular vehicle chosen, because it makes me think of velociraptors and, like...
yes! Oh my
god! And then
gosh.
I imagine Calpurnia yes. and them riding around on velociraptors.
Oh my gosh. So, IAPA 2017 happened, and that's the big convention for amusement park rides and carnival stuff. And they have reinvented the steeplechase, which, readers and listeners, you probably know what a steeplechase is because we know your demographics. But if you don't, it is essentially a roller coaster where you ride a horse. And the company that brought it back made velociraptor steeplechases.
Oh my god!
So you can ride a velociraptor!
That's amazing!
I need this in out. My life.
Oh. I'm going to find out where it is, and I'm going to make Hannah take me, because Hannah, girlfriend of the podcast, is from Florida, which is closer to Orlando than I am. I'm going to make her go, and I'm going to ride on it all day. I'm just going to ride on the velociraptors
that
all day.
That sounds amazing.
Yes,
they're going to
be
like, ma'am, there are children. Yes, I am a child of the heart.
I am very small.
Yeah, speaking of lizardy creatures, can we talk about how darling A through L
yes.
is and how everybody needs a friend like him?
Oh, he would have been my best friend as a
God,
child.
Yes. Oh. Me too. And I would have tried and read the rest of the library so that then we could be library buddies.
Yes.
And I could help him with M through Z.
Oh my gosh. Oh, he is just the sweetest. Gosh. And he's so self-sacrificing and just all around one of the best sidekick characters you could hope for.
And knowing Catherine Valente is somebody who deals with chronic pain and, you know, somebody who now lives with it, the whole... So in the book, flying creatures except for leopards aren't allowed. Like, if you can fly, you have to have your wings chained up. So... A through L has his wings chained up with iron and it hurts him terribly. And despite all of that, like, he just keeps going in life because it's like he has to. And because it is who he is. And like, it's not written as a, oh, I am overcoming this. It's written as a, I have to do this because I must, because I have to do the right thing by my friends and by my family. It's like, oh, aww. L, I love you.
Yeah. Oh. He's such a... I love... Okay, I love bookworms with a Y. Mercedes Lackey wrote a delightful bookworm in one of her 500 Kingdoms series. You know, dragons who hoard books instead of jewels. But I love the idea of a wyvern like Elle who doesn't just enjoy books but is books.
Yes. Well, I'm just thinking about how much I love him.
Yeah.
As a kid who's like best, I mean, I had very good human best friends, but you know, my a very deep part of me, you know, was best friends with the library.
Absolutely. Yes.
And her giving that to children who also feel like their best friend is the library, it's just like, oh my gosh. But he is not the only character who is part of the journey. So we also have Saturday at the Marid.
This whole relationship, especially Saturday himself as a character, and I know I keep relating to other books and going off on tangents because they remind me of other things, but that's how I relate to books.
That's how we do too.
It has very strong shades of Inkheart. He is a lot like Fareed in so many ways. It was really interesting to see.
That's a series I have to finish. I read the first one, made me cry. It was amazing.
Me too.
I have to read. A lot of things make me cry. I'm old. And again, without getting into spoilers, the development of their relationship is really good and very interesting because I feel like he occupies the quote-unquote girl role in this kind of...
You know like what he I has was... To be, oh, go ahead.
I was going to say he has to be rescued. He is finding things out in a crafty way behind the scenes, but he is not forefront in the action. And in the end, he has to make a giant sacrifice to make sure the heroine goes on her way.
Yeah, he's offering the silent, loving support that the female usually offers to the male protagonist.
Exactly. Oh, I saw A Wrinkle in Time yesterday. I'm assuming you've both seen it.
I haven't yet, but I want to.
I loved it. And the reason I bring it up is, well, of course, this book reminds me a lot of not necessarily the book, but the movie Wrinkle in Time. And Saturday's relationship with September reminds me a lot of Calvin and Meg, especially things we see hinted at the end. I think they have that similar kind of loving relationship that grows through working through adversity together and going through a quest together.
Yeah. I really enjoyed in the book A Wrinkle in Time, Calvin and Meg's relationship because he's so bold and brash and outspoken, but he just puts everything aside to support her and unquestioningly believes in how smart and good she is when she doesn't. Which, like, should be the role of every love interest, especially when it's the male to the side taking the traditional female role. I really enjoy seeing that. And Saturday, I don't know if I got as attached to him because he didn't have as much time, maybe, to shine. And he was very quiet.
Yeah.
But I can definitely see the connection there because it's very similar.
In the second book, he becomes something very interesting indeed. Now, I have a question for the two of you, related but not. Is A Wrinkle in Time a YA novel?
No.
If this is, then A Wrinkle in Time is my opinion. But a lot of books span multiple categories, and A Wrinkle in Time is one of those. Especially the other novels in the time quartet or quintet, whichever.
Right. I would say Many Waters, absolutely YA. Acceptable Time, absolutely YA. The first three books, I'd say kind of span. I think Wrinkle in Time is definitely more in the middle grade area. Same with Wind in a Door. And then Swiftly Tilting Planet, I think, starts moving a bit beyond to young adult. But it's the same with this book, where no matter what age you are going to get so much out of it.
And Swiftly Tilting Planet is the other literary tattoo that I have.
Oh, wow. Tell us about it.
It's the St. Patrick's rune from the Lorica. And on the other side of my back from it is the one from So You Want to Be a Wizard, which is the Wizard's Oath. because when Amazing. I was a very young child, oh, wow. those are the books that I read, and those are the passages that stuck with me the most and inspired my taste in other books. Among with many, many, many others, wow. of course.
So many books, so many tattoos, so little skin.
I know. Need more Bigfoot and Bob next episode. How does Layla get more skin?
I have two tattoos. One is literary. I'm planning on more. One is an illustration from Cindy Crabb's Doris. It's a little kitty. Cindy Crabb is one of those writers whose zine writing and like experiential writing was a big influence on me. And, you know, of course, I love my cats. It was really to test out how my skin reacts with ink.
Good idea.
And sad to say, it stays on my body, so I can't give you any of mine. And then I have a big one on my back. And this is going to be a host re-donates $5 to Casa Ruby. We are up to $15. I have an evil ex called Empress Palpatine. And she told me, if you put up a Georgia O'Keeffe, I will never darken your door ever again. So, on my back is an amalgamation of two Georgia O'Keeffe paintings.
Phenomenal. I love it.
It was so painful. Oh my God. Yeah. But I would do it over again. And I'm getting more. And I mean, I imagine like the Francesca Black tattoo is coming. And my A-Camp tattoo is coming. Aww. And my podcast tattoo is coming.
Yeah, my only really big colorful piece is a phoenix over my entire upper arm on the right side, cool. and then a big scroll with quill pens on the back of my left shin. But
those sound beautiful.
Yeah, that was my first one. It was a oof, painful.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, my little one on my ankle. I was like, I was laughing because my artist was really cute and. Same artist did my back piece, and I was crying so, like, it hurt. Like, upper back hurts. Yeah. I was crying so hard I had an asthma attack.
Oh, my God.
Really,
oh, yeah. My tattoo artist was 8 months pregnant when she did my arm piece, and I was like, are you sure you don't want to go, like, wait until you had your babies and recovered? Because she was leaning over her enormous stomach to do the tattoo. Can't be comfortable.
Oh, my God.
I mean, at that stage, I think you get kind of nesty and you have to, from what I've understood from pregnant relatives and coworkers, like you have to be doing something. And I guess if inking skin is one of those things, power to her.
Yes.
She was just so small and she had like two babies inside her.
Oh, my goodness.
So if you were to pick a tattoo from the illustrations in this book, which are gorgeous, and we haven't talked about them yet.
Yeah.
What would you pick?
Autumn? Something autumn related?
The velocipede picture on page 112 that opens the great velocipede migration.
God, that's so good.
It's so beautiful. Or the pouty Marquess when we meet her in chapter 8.
I don't remember if there is an illustration of the key who is so meaningful.
Yeah, on the cover.
And woven through the narrative. Right. So I want the key.
I love the key. I never thought I'd say that, but I know.
Oh, she is wonderfully adept at making inanimate characters real.
Oh my God, the jacket.
I know. Aww.
I never have felt so much love for a jacket. Except for the denim jacket that I got when I was in fourth grade and I thought it made me look like Tiffany. But other than that... this one.
Yeah, adorable. Gleam captured my heart in like two paragraphs.
Yes.
So a little Catherine Valente background. She spent many years of her life as a living in Japan. Her partner at the time was in the military, so she spent a lot of time, you know, being an expat, and she picked up lots and lots and lots of Japanese mythos and it is woven throughout her stories in a really beautiful way. And that scene with the characters, because those are real yokai, there are objects that have lasted over 100 years, and when they last over 100 years, they become real. And Gleam the Lantern is just so loving and darling, and I'm...
She's good. That chapter killed me as someone who loves all vintage things and does a lot of vintage shopping and wandering around in antique stores. Oh my god. Yeah. Beautiful and terrifying. And please don't hurt me, inanimate objects. Please don't hurt me.
I've seen some vintage dolls that I would be real upset if they came to life after 100 years.
Oh, creep.
You are talking to two girls who love creepy dolls.
I was just going to say, what would you do if you were locked in a creepy doll shop and they started acting like those characters?
I think I've had a dream like that.
I mean, most of them are made of porcelain. Just saying. It's not that tough.
And composition, which is, I mean, it's tough, but it's not unbreakable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
we could take the dolls down, is what you're saying.
I could go.
The dolls better watch out.
I could go full Bruce Campbell in Evil Dead and start strap on a chainsaw and go to town.
I've got one watching me right now.
Uh-oh.
And she's giving me this look like, I could take you. Don't get any ideas.
Well, she's keeping your attention while the other ones sneak up on you, so.
Yep.
I hope Neil isn't listening and prone to pranking. I mean, he's too sweet for that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm usually the one who has put that doll in creepy places. Sorry.
So if you were a kid reading this, or even as an adult reading this, are there any scenes that you think would have haunted you?
You mean like affected me and stuck in my mind, or like haunted, like scared?
Both.
Ooh. The part in the autumn woods after she meets, you know, can I say it? Is that a spoiler?
I don't think so. I think this is a quest narrative.
As,
and the first in a series.
After she meets her death, that was very affecting. And I think very brave, because you don't often see a protagonist physically affected like that in so strong a way.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was nice, actually. And then she goes on her little Life of Pi journey, but that would have stuck with me. I don't think any of the parts in the book would have scared me as a child, necessarily, because I was a lot less easy to scare as a child, but that one would have stuck in my mind, I think.
The Marquess's story, as we learn it near the end of the book, that's haunting me now, and I think it probably would have haunted me then. And Marie, you mentioned that earlier as something that's just absolutely heartbreaking.
For me, it's her, as Layla said, the Life of Pi journey.
Mm-hmm.
Being cold, wet, lonely, having to kill a fish, and sobbing, and also
yes.
being alone, when in so little of the book is she ever alone, and she is so deeply alone during this journey.
And it was grueling. It was a lot more realistic and harsh than the rest of the book in a pretty jarring way, but I think it was probably necessary to really drive home the point.
I read two books in the last week that involved some really, really graphic and hard to read, killing animals for food stories. And wow.
So you're telling us you read Wild.
I read I Am Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter, which I did want to continue to recommend to you, but like every time I went to recommend it to you and say, hey, it's really turning out great, I had another content warning to add to the list. So,
oh, there was a pretty graphic animal experience in one of the books I was reading that I just love. But it's, you know, killing a deer to survive in The Man Who Fell in Love with the Moon. That was a little hard. Not because it was necessarily written gruesomely, but maybe it was written better than you usually read in the sort of Jack London survival stories.
So in the wake of the Wilder Award being renamed, I decided to go reread the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, which, you know, I am an adult. I can make those decisions. Yep. Do I think they still need to be in print? Not really. They work better as scholarly works and or reading if you want to read about early, oh God, libertarians. Because Rose Wilder Lane, staunch libertarian, put a lot of her feelings into those books.
Yeah, which
books.
I never noticed as a small child.
Yeah, so lots of gruesome butchering in those books. Yeah.
What is the Wilder Award called now, by the way?
They're working on it, I think.
They
I
are
haven't
working
seen
on it.
An outcome for that. And I think it's good. I think it's a step absolutely in the right direction. Like, you don't have to take a book away, but you should think, like, if you're rewarding an author for their legacy of work, think about whose legacies you want to honor. And that's a rock fact. Carrie, have you seen Over the Garden Wall?
I still haven't.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
I know. I need to carve out, like, a very specific like amount of time and be in just the right mind space, because I know that I'm going to love it and I want to give it the attention it deserves.
Yes, this autumn you build yourself a little nest of blankets, you get all your pumpkin accoutrement, you turn the lights down low, you carve a pumpkin, and then you sit down and watch it, and it's phenomenal.
Especially if you love this book, readers and listeners, if you don't love this book, if you love autumn with all of your heart and soul, or even if you just think that pumpkin pie spice lattes
if
are
if you're
neat,
a human being
go
with a face and a soul.
Heart. And some extra skin.
Yeah, if you're a human being with some extra skin, call me.
And then go watch Over the Garden Wall.
And listen to it, too. There's some really, really incredible music in it.
There is a beautiful, I was going to say hi-fi. No, that's what you play it on. There's a record of the music, and it's beautiful. It's beautifully packaged. And I think the music would be really nice to go alongside a read of this book if you don't mind music with words.
It's kind of crazy that you mentioned that, because I was at a friend's apartment last night having drinks, and he had that album that you're describing, and we took it out and listened to it.
Oh, wow.
Yes, Carrie, as a musician, you will really enjoy that. And I think maybe this Spooktober, we might need to do a special episode about
yes. it. Yes, I think that sounds like a great idea.
And Bigfoot and Bob should come be
yeah,
on
we
it.
Might do our own Over the
Yay!
Garden Wall thing, or combine our talents.
Yeah.
Yes. By our powers combined.
Heart.
Skin. Oh my God, Carrie, can you put the clip of the singer-ing making the skin noise there?
Just me bringing a little horror to every podcast I'm on.
Oh, that's what we look for.
Yeah, that's why you're here. So final thoughts, I guess. I guess that's where we are. Marie, you've read the sequels too. So tell us, should we keep going? Should we read the rest of them?
Absolutely keep reading. The middle book has middle book syndrome. Just get through it. It's got a really good ending. And it's on the moon, so what's not to love? The fourth book is really, really fun. And then the fifth book ties things up so beautifully, no loose ends. It's great. Read them all. I was going to have a quote for my final thoughts, so you all should have your final thoughts while I pick one.
My final thought is, why on earth did I let this book sit on my shelf for so long? What is wrong with me? And now there are all these sequels that I have to read and I know I'm going to love, so I need to get reading.
My final thought is, I wish this book had been around when I was a kid, because though there are books like it, I think it would have helped any of the lonely, bookish children out there, the ravished children like September was, would appreciate a friend in the girl who circumnavigated fairyland.
Marie, did you find your quote?
I did. And this is where she's starting out on her journey and figure out who or what or where the story is going to take her. The trouble was, September didn't know what kind of story she was in. Was it a merry one or a serious one? How ought she to act? If it was merry, she might dash after a spoon, and it would all be a marvelous adventure, with funny rhymes and somersaults, and a grand party with red lanterns at the end. But if it was a serious tale, she might have to do something important, something involving, with snow and arrows and enemies. Of course, we would like to tell her which, but no one may know the shape of the tale in which they move, and perhaps we do not truly know what kind of beast it is, either. Stories have a way of changing faces. They are unruly things, undisciplined, given to delinquency and the throwing of erasers. This is why we must close them up into thick, solid books so they cannot get out and cause trouble.
I think that's my favorite passage in the book. So beautiful.
Absolutely.
Sigh. So, Layla, do you have a read-alike?
I do indeed. I know that Diana Wynne Jones has been covered on this podcast before, but I don't believe you mentioned, or if you did, it was brief, The Chronicles of Crestomancy. And correct me if I'm wrong.
Friend of the podcast, Lisa, is a really big fan of them, but we only touched on them very, very briefly.
Right. I think we might have mentioned them in the first version of that podcast, possibly not the second. Mm-hmm. So tell us about them.
So I have two read-alikes, and one of them is The Chronicles of Crestomancy. Just my absolute favorite Diana Wynne Jones book. Well, books, I suppose, because Volume 1 has actually two stories that are connected, Charmed Life and The Lives of Christopher Chant. They're unique, which I find rare because there's always echoes of other stories within a story that you read, even if you love it. But these brought something new to the table, which I find charming and rare. It has witches, it has cats, it has enchanters and scheming and drama and English boarding schools. It's just amazing, and everyone should read it. And the protagonists are a little bit like September. Unfortunately, they are boys, but they have that same sort of self-aware, plucky, stubborn nature that she does, and I think you'll greatly enjoy them.
That sounds great.
Yeah, they're excellent. And they have stayed with me to such a degree that whenever I trip on the subway, I'm like, did one of my lives go by?
Yes. Oh, my God. That nine lives set up in Crestomancy is just amazing.
You said you had another book.
Yes. This one, I don't know if anyone will see the connection because it's a very, very, very different book. But throughout reading The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland, I couldn't help thinking of it, so I thought I might as well mention it briefly. It's called Samarkand by Amin Maalouf, translated by Russell Harris. And it's do you know the Rubaiyat by Omar Khayyam?
Yes.
This is a novel about the Rubaiyat, weaving together a modern-day tale of its discovery with the history of it itself. And it's beautiful to read, and I think what made me connect it in my head with The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland is some of the more out-there, unique writing style. I don't know, maybe no one else will see the connection and I'm just making weird leaps, but I think everyone should read it anyway because it has some beautiful poetry and it'll get you interested in Omar Khayyam, which everyone should be.
Awesome. Yeah, I will definitely check that out.
Same.
Yeah, the Rubaiyat is a favorite book of a favorite fictional heroine of both Carrie and I. So we definitely have to check it out.
Perfect.
That and Ivanhoe.
Oh, all right.
Carrie, how about you?
My read-alike for this week is The Night Circus by Erin Morgenstern. Because if you want to roll around in some atmospheric, descriptive writing, the sensory details and just the charm on every single page of this book is very similar to what you'll find in The Night Circus.
Okay, I have two read-alikes, and one of them you can read on the internet. Well, both you can if you have a ebook reader. The first is The Raven and the Reindeer by T. Kingfisher, also known as Ursula Vernon, who is a very good friend of Catherine Valente. She has a series of retold fairy tales. This is her retelling of the Snow Queen, and it's about a very plucky and strong Goethe who wants to save her best friend and runs into many, many obstacles on her way to the Snow Queen, including a very chatty, gender-fluid raven and a beautiful pirate thief queen. It's really, really good so far. It is solidly YA to adult. It's quite a gory book, but it's stunningly written and such a very deeply, like, I identify so much with the heroine. And, you know, it makes you feel so many things. It's a good book, and I can't wait to read her other fairy tale retellings. And the other is a short story called In the House of the Seven Librarians by Ellen Clages. It's about a little girl who is a changeling who was raised by seven librarians.
Oh, wow.
It was originally published on Uncanny Magazine online. I will put a link to it, and I will probably put it in the social media. It's just so good. And if you love this book, which is a book that also loves books, you will love the short story.
That sounds so good.
Yeah, I'm going to have to give that a read. When I was a kid, I always wished I was Lyra being raised by all the professors in Oxford in the Golden Compass.
Yes.
So being raised by seven librarians sounds pretty neat.
Yeah. Amen. I just put a link to it in the chat.
Excellent. I can't wait to check that out. So what's everybody currently reading?
Layla, you should go first as our guest.
I am reading The Swarm. It's a sci-fi realistic fiction eco-revenge book. It's very long. It's not young adult. But it is very interesting, and it can teach you some scientific stuff, especially about marine biology. Although some of the marine biology in this is wildly inaccurate, of course. But it's about a really interesting idea, which is what if life evolved alongside mankind, but under the ocean in a completely different direction? And what if the ocean got sick of us trashing it? Ooh. And the plot actually runs parallel to Christopher Moore's Fluke, but it's not as goofy cool. And crazy as Fluke is. But if you've read Fluke, you get the idea of where this story is going. It has a lot of unlikable protagonists, but it has some very likable ones as well, and the descriptions are great. And it's awesome to see animals who have been wronged taking revenge.
Wow.
That's amazing. If you like that, you should read Into the Drowning Deep by Mira Grant, which is essentially Vengeance of the Mermaids. Ooh. And it's like a bio-science fiction thriller. I don't know how accurate the science is. I am not a scientist. It worked for me. And it also has a lot to say about humanity and language, and it's also super gory and exciting.
Nice.
So, I am currently reading Emergent Strategy, Shaping Change, Changing Worlds by Adrienne Marie Brown. And it is a book about how systems of creation in nature can also be used to be better people to each other and people in societies and people as stewards of the earth. It's incredible. It's made me cry within the first 50 pages. So absolutely 100% read it. If you want to live a better life, if you want to be righteous to each other, or even if you just love nature and want to read about systems and patterns, it's a really good book.
I was going to say you should follow it up with The Man with the Compound Eyes, which is all about systems and patterns in nature and change.
Ooh, I am adding that to my list right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
Ooh, excellent, mm-hmm. Thank you.
So way over here at the other side of the world, the other side of books, I just finished reading This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America by Morgan Jerkins. It's a fabulous collection of essays. And at the same time, I've been reading and just finished I Am Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter by Erica Sanchez, which is a great YA novel set here in Chicago. They are both books that are at times very hard to read, but they are so, so worth it. I highly recommend both of them.
Wow.
I wasn't
Fantastic.
Prepared to talk about animal uprisings this week, but I will know for next time.
The frog's revenge.
They got a bad rap last week. They had that association with Jackson. No good. So readers and listeners, you can find us online on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can get in touch with us through email. We'll have all that information in the show notes. So you can talk to us, send us critiques, send us compliments. Do not send us sentient furniture.
Or skin.
Thank you very much. Or send us skin, though. We love skin. Send us skin. All your skin.
Skin. We need to insert that sound effect first. We have to find it.
I'm sure we can find it. This is what the internet was made for.
The best thing is curling up next to your partner at night when the lights are out and going, skin, skin.
I usually go with the old, don't look out the window now.
I just let the creepy dolls do the work for me.
And, oh my goodness, you should listen to all of the Bigfoot and Bob. They are a little baby podcast growing really, really fast, so you'll be able to knock out all those episodes in an afternoon and then be along for the ride because it's super fun, super endearing, really funny, very cathartic, lots of meowing about.
And my own personal website, I am actually most active on Tumblr, funnily enough, after all these years. My Tumblr URL is at rarity, RAR1TY. And my personal writing project is on Wattpad. So I hope you have an account. It's called Danny and I Survived. And it's a little bit like the first half of The Stand. And it's a very personal exploration of my own childhood and also the apocalypse.
Amazing. We will put that all in the Ooh. Show notes.
Thank you so much for being here. It has been
Thank
so much
you.
Fun.
This has been a blast. I love it.
Thanks for not being super creeped out when I decided to go out and friend you guys.
Nothing creeps me out. I'm a horror enthusiast.
I know. Someday we'll also send Layla your creepypasta. Your creepiest
oh, right.
creepypasta, because there is a contest to creep out Bigfoot and Bob, and I did not win it, but I'm gonna
yeah,
keep trying.
Because so far I've never been scared by a creepypasta, and let me tell you, if you do send me one that actually manages to creep me, I will not lie. I will let you know how creeped I was. This is an honesty thing. and I want to be creeped. Boo.
Excellent. All right. Readers and listeners, this has been Go Your Own YA. I'm Marie.
I'm Carrie.
And I'm Layla.
Yay!
Do something good for yourself.
And bad for the patriarchy.
And good for your skin, because we need it.
All right. Yay!
Yay!